for the kind introduction. I'm very honored to be here. I thank Microsoft and Yonsei University for hosting me. And as Wei-Ying mentioned, I'm going to be talking about democratizing urban data analysis. And this is an area that I started to work on after I joined NYU a little bit over 5 years ago. And you may ask me, what is the big deal here, right? And what is the big deal about urban data? If you look at cities, are the center of economic activity, but it also they're the source of many of the innovations and approaches for the big problems we're facing in the 21st century, right? More than 50% of the world population already lives in cities, and this number is slated to grow to 70% by 2050. Right? And as we all know, people who live in big cities like Seoul, this growth actually leads to several problems regarding pollution, resource consumption, housing affordability, and aging infrastructure. Right? The good news is that now, with big data and with all these cheap and abundant sensors, we have actually amassed huge amounts of data about the different components of a city, the infrastructure, the environment, and the residents of the city. Right? And with this data combined with analytical methods as well as predictive models, there's a lot that we can do, and there's a lot of opportunities to make cities more efficient and improve the lives of their residents. And we have already seen a number of success stories where urban data has been, put to good use. One good example that I like to mention is this project called One Bus Away, which started at University of Washington, but now has actually been deployed at multiple cities in the US. And basically, they use open bus data to provide very accurate predictions of when buses are going to arrive. Right? So it had many benefits in terms of perceived wait. People, riders are waiting much less time. And it also had an unintended benefit, which is people know when the bus is going to arrive so they can walk to the next bus stops. So essentially that has an unintended public health benefit. So this is a very good example of urban data being used to benefit the residents. In New York City, and probably at Seoul too, property prices are very, very high, right? So it happens that property owners often try to fit more dwellings and more people in spaces than what is allowed by law. And this can lead to very unsafe conditions, particularly leading to serious situations like fires, right? So this is what is called illegal conversions, putting more people and more dwellings in a small space, right? And New York City gets over 25,000 illegal conversion complaints, but they only have 200 inspectors to actually go after and see if there are real problems. So during the Bloomberg administration, Mike Flowers put together a team of data scientists, and they integrated data from 19 different agencies. And they looked for data that provided some indications of issues in buildings, like crime, rodent infestation, late taxes, late electricity bills. Right? And what they did is they correlated that with 5 years of fire data. And with that, they created a predictive model which increased the hit rate for inspections from 13 to 70%. Right? So this is a great example of urban data being put to use to make cities more efficient, right, on the smart city side. And last but not least, at NYU, we have the Furman Center for Real Estate and Policy. And for decades, they've been doing data-driven research. And with their work, they've actually been able to influence many policy designs around New York City. So for example, they were able to influence city spending decisions on subsidized housing by showing the benefits of actually having more subsidized housing in New York City, as well as in updates on policing strategies when we had the foreclosure crisis in the United States, right? So we have all these success stories, but in my opinion, they're very far and few in between. And the reason for that is analyzing and exploring urban data is very challenging, is very hard, right? So we have these different components, infrastructure, residents, and environment, and they interact in very complex ways. And to understand these interactions, we have to analyze large volumes of heterogeneous data, the exhaust from these different components, right? And the problem is compounded by the fact that we're looking at urban processes that happen over time and space, and this makes the analysis even more complex. Right? So in this era of big data, lots of people try to focus on challenges related to the data size, the volume, right? And what I claim is that, you know, if you're talking about doing batch computations over large data, this problem, you know, we've worked in computer science for the last couple of decades, and we have very good solutions for that. So I would say that scalability for batch computations is not a big deal. What is a big deal, I claim, is scalability for people. Why? Because to go from data to knowledge, we actually have to go through a very tortuous, time-consuming process that requires knowledge about many different techniques, algorithms, data mining, machine learning, statistics, mathematics, right? And this process is hard regardless of whether the data are big or are small, right? And if you look at the what is the common practice for urban data analysis? And we've done several interviews with domain experts. Usually, they start with some hypothesis. They have a data scientist or a team of data scientists that go look for some particular data slices, use some tools, Excel, Stata, R, right, to generate some plots, which are then presented to the domain expert. And then you know, the domain expert makes some inferences, maybe proves or disproves their hypothesis. But this is a very iterative process, right? And having you know, the data scientist in the middle makes the process utterly inefficient, limiting the ability of the domain expert who actually understands the problem, right, and distancing him or her from the data that they understand, right? So what we'd like to do is, you know, change this, right? Go from this vicious and inefficient cycle to a more virtual cycle where we actually give tools and techniques that help the domain experts themselves explore their data so that they can find, integrate, interactively explore, and explain the data that they need to study, right? And it's very important for us. I mean, in computer science, we love to develop new methods, new algorithms. And one thing that we haven't been very good at is actually developing techniques and methods that we can put at the hands of experts that do not have computing training or computing expertise, right? So we should try to automate as much as possible these tedious tasks, as well as guide users in the data exploration process, right? So this is where the democratization comes. We should be able to allow everybody, all the data enthusiasts, all domain experts, to actually analyze their data. All right, so today, I'll be talking about work that we've done towards democratizing urban data analysis. So I'll tell you a little bit about, you know, how some tools and methods we built to enable experts to interrogate urban data in an interactive fashion, as well as methods we've developed to guide users in the exploration, both into finding interesting data slices, as well as discovering relationships across different data sets so that they can explain these events or features they find in the data. Right? But before I tell you about the work, let me tell you about you know, my favorite urban data set of all time, and which is taxi trips in New York City. And I'm going to use this as an example to illustrate the methods we have developed. Right, so here you can see a plot that shows the number of taxi trips every day over 2 years. In red, I have 2011, and in blue, I have 2012. And the first time that I saw this plot, the most striking feature is the regularity. Right, so you can see that year after year, the patterns are the same. So it really captures the beat of the city. You see New Year's, you see Christmas, you see Thanksgiving, and we even see here an uptick in number of taxi rides in the evening of Valentine's Day, right? So they really capture what happens in the city. And if you zoom into the data, you can also find additional interesting features. Here we have four different time slices on a Sunday, May 1st, 2011. Right? And you can see that between 7 and 8 a.m., and the blue dots are the pickups, and the orange dots are the drop-offs of the taxis. So you see that between 7 and 8 a.m., there's lots of people, taxis, roaming in New York City. But then between, and I cannot find my mouse, okay, between 8 and 10 a.m., you know, it looks like something is happening around 6th Avenue. There are no taxis there. Right, and then traffic comes back to normal between 10 and 11. Right? Are there any bike enthusiasts in the audience? And you'd know what happens on the 1st May of Sunday in New York City, which is the 5 Borough Bike Tour. And in this case, 6th Avenue is closed for the bikes to go through. Right? So what you can see is that taxis are actually unsuspecting sensors that can give unprecedented insight into city, different aspects of city lives, including economic activity, human behavior, and mobility patterns. Right? So you can use the taxi data as a proxy to ask lots of important questions, like, you know, how people move in the city, how long it takes to go from point A to point B at the particular time of the day, how traffic is impacted when there are certain kinds of events like the parade or the presidential visits, right? You can also look for what are the popular night spots, and the young people are going to want to know that, as well as some, you know, serious studies that look for signs of gentrification, right? So this data is a gold mine, and that has been available for a long time. So what does it consist of? We have about 500,000 taxi trips every day in New York, and it's about 868 million trips over the last 5 years. And the data are complex. It's spatial tempered. It has information about pickup, latitude and longitude of pickup, drop-off times for pickups and drop-offs, as well as additional attributes, including you know, distance traveled, fare, tip, tolls, and so on. Right? And one issue is that even though these data have been available for a while, policymakers and scientists haven't been able to explore, interactively explore their whole data. They usually, their analysis is, you know, limited to small time slices. Right? So the first project we embarked on was, can we actually develop a usable interface that enables these domain experts to efficiently and interactively explore the taxi data, right? And here's what we came up with. We designed a language that allow users to explore the data visually and query the data visually. So they can step through different time slots and try to look for patterns in the data. They can examine recurrent time patterns all the Sundays between 0 and 1 a.m. And you can see what the behavior is. You can also specify query spatial constraints in your queries. It's going to be the next one. So you can select arbitrary polygons and look at what are all the trips in that particular region and what are the trips in these two regions. And you can also have origin-destination queries, right, which are very useful when you're trying to study human mobility. Find me all the trips that start in one region and end on the other region. Right? And there's a number of other features in the system. And if you'd like to see a full video that showcases all these features, you can go to the website, www.taxiviz.org. Oh, and here is something that people like, which is like given a region, figuring out where the taxis go, right? So you have this nice, cute animation. So through those visual operations, we actually are able to attain usability, right? So users can actually select and query the data visually, and they don't, oops, I think that something wrong with this slide. So here, where the boxes are, they're supposed to be a SQL query. And the point is that, you know, instead of forcing domain experts to learn a query language like SQL, they can actually build that query. And that query is built behind the scenes, right? And all that they do is actually visually manipulate the data, right? Another important feature that our users like very much is this: is that with this framework, we're actually unified data selection and data analytics, right? If you remember the modus operandi, you know, people usually select data. They get the data from the database or from their file system, and then they use a separate tool like Excel and so on to analyze the data. By doing so, you actually lose the spatial temporal context of your analysis, right? Here, by unifying both, you can actually do your analysis and see the analytics here in the bottom while maintaining the spatial temporal context, right? Okay, so attaining usability is just the first step, right? The next question is, you know, how do you actually evaluate these queries in an interactive fashion? There's a recent paper by Liu and here in TVCG 2014 where they do a study and show that if you have long waits, long latencies for these queries, it greatly reduces the rate at which users make observations, draw generalizations, and generate hypotheses, right? So it's of utmost importance that when you're doing exploration, that these queries have to be evaluated really, really fast, right? So if you get one query like this one, find all trips that occurred between Lo and Manhattan at the two airports on all Sundays in May 2011, this is a kind of query, a typical query that is supported by our system, right? If you try to evaluate this query using Postgres, it takes 500 seconds, right? We tried also a commercial database, which I cannot name. It's much better, it takes 20 seconds, but it's still not interactive, right? And the reason for this is that these queries are complex. They involve arbitrary polygons, and these pointing polygon tests that are required can be very, very expensive. So the question that we try to answer is, can we actually support interactive response rates for these complex queries? And since you've already seen the video, you know that the answer is yes. It was a spoiler, right? But now I can tell you how we did it. So we support these interactive queries by actually using a cleverly designed index structure based on KV trees and combining that with graphical processing units, GPUs, right? So if you look at KV trees, they've been widely used in the computer graphics community, but often for in-memory data, right? And the main benefit for KDTs is this ability to do simultaneous filtering over multiple attributes. For the queries that we have to answer, this is really good because essentially it avoids the need to join the results from multiple indices on different attributes. And they also reduce or minimize the number of pointing polygon tests, which are very, very expensive, right? So what we did is we extended KV trees to support a block-based structure so that it can work with out-of-core data, right? So the idea is that, we can create big blocks to put all the records. So maybe I should go back, right? So the idea is that you have the tree nodes are the KV tree, that's fine, and then the leaf nodes of the KV tree are stored in disk in these big blocks, right, and a big set of records. By creating these big blocks, what we do is that we make the tree really small. It can fit in memory, so you greatly reduce the cost of index access time, right? And you can say, oh, no, but then it's going to be slow to search over the blocks, and that's where the GPUs come into play, right? We can actually search these blocks very fast in parallel using the GPUs, which can also speed up the pointing polygon tests, right? So just to give you an idea, here's some performance data. So we got some queries similar to the one that I showed you before. And we have four queries varying the spatial constraints and the time constraints. But on average, these queries have about 13,000 results. And here are the times for Postgres and the commercial database, which vary anywhere between 20 and 500 seconds, right? So we implemented our index in MongoDB. And here are the times that we actually get. So for these queries, we get way below 1 second, really interactive times, right? So we get speed ups anywhere between 270 and 6,700 times. So it's a huge, huge difference, right? So if you'd like to see more details about the work and the index, you can actually check our paper. And if you'd like to use or contribute to the system, the tool, where you can actually access it on GitHub. So you can ask me, okay, you did that, the tool, you, what happened, right? So we have close collaboration with a number of New York City agencies, in particular with the Department of Transportation and the Taxi and Limousine Commission. So we implemented this, both the visual language and the version of the index into an open source tool, and we demoed the first prototype to these two agents, DOT and TLC. Immediately after the demo, we get a message saying, we're truly blown away. And later, after they used the system for a bit, the assistant commissioner wrote to us that the speed at which the tool permits us to work has saved multiple hours of staff time and has dramatically improved the unit's output and capabilities. So I think that this serves as a very good example where, you know, research and computer science, in particular in visualization, visual analytics, combined with, you know, databases, very fast database access, can actually lead to, you know, huge improvements in how people can actually analyze and explore data. Right? Our system is open source. You can find it on GitHub, download it, contribute to it. And I should note that even though we developed the systems with taxi data as motivation, we've actually used the same infrastructure to analyze different kinds of data sets, including city bikes, energy consumption, as well as property ownership patterns in New York. And I think that with the system, I think it kind of like plants a seed for what I see as the GIS, or Geographical Information System of the future, which should be scalable and support very powerful analytics. And there's ongoing work in our group that is actually moving that direction. So if you're interested, you can just Google Urbane, NYU, and then you're going to find a video and papers about that system. Right? Okay, so we can explore data. We can interactively explore very large spatial-temporal data. But still, there are just too many slices to look at. I mean, in a single year, we have 365 times 24 one-hour data slices. And the question is, which slices should we actually look at? Which ones are interesting? The usual approach to analyze this kind of data is to do different kinds of aggregations. Right? So here on the top, we can actually get all the taxi trips, and we can aggregate over space, and we can create these plots that show how the number of trips vary over time in different days. Or you can aggregate over time and see, you know, the trip patterns throughout the whole day, but in different parts of the city. Right? The problem with this approach is that you can actually miss interesting slices. Right? So here's that May 1st, that five boroughs bike tour. And when you aggregate the data, you really don't see, you know, that road closure there. Right? Can we do better? Right? So the next project next problem that we attacked was, you know, can we actually create an automated method to automatically find these interesting slices. And here we borrowed ideas from computational topology, which I think is an area that can greatly contribute to data analytics, and this is actually starting to happen. Right? So how does this work? How can we use computational topology to find interesting data slices? The first step is that when you get a data set, you model it at a time-varying scalar function. And in this particular project, we do that on top of a graph. So if you get the taxi data, you can view the graph as being the road network in New York City. Right? And you can use different functions. For our first study, we actually used the density of taxis. So you can like figure out on the edges or on the nodes or the vertices how many taxis are actually present at any point in time. Right? And in computational topology, you actually have very efficient data structures to find features in these functions. So when you model your function through a time-varying scalar function, you end up with something that resembles a surface. And there are very efficient methods that find the critical points in these functions. Right? And the intuition is that, you know, the points of maxima and minima in these functions actually correspond to interesting regions. And the intuition is that the region is going to be interesting if its behavior differs from the behavior of its neighborhood. Right? So for the taxi data, just to give you a concrete example, the minima points of minima actually corresponds to regions where the density is lower than their neighborhood, and these often correspond to road blockages or accidents, right, where you have very few taxis in a particular region. Whereas points of maxima correspond to popular taxi locations, for example, major transportation hubs or touristic locations in the city. Right? Okay, so this method is very efficient. And then the next problem that we ran into is that we find events, but we just find too many of them. right? Because when we look at this topological, a real event like a Macy's Parade or the Five Borough Bike Tour, they're actually composed of many tiny events, depending on the kind of like time slot that you actually consider, right? So to address this problem, we actually cluster the events based on their geometric and topological similarity. And we create an index that allows users to easily explore the different events, right? So here's an example of a simple interactive interface where a user can see the events and try to filter them based on different attributes. In this case, you know, small to large events, as well as short to long running events, right? And by selecting the dots in the plot, they can actually inspect what the event looks like. And because we have this index, another feature or another benefit of the method is that once you find a particular event that you like and you're interested in, you can actually query for similar events. So in this case, we have the Five Borough Bike Tour, and if we look for use the index to look for similar events, we find all these different events here: the Dominican Day Parade, a Gaza Solidarity Protest, as well as a Five Borough Bike Tour in the following year. And if you look, they all have a very similar shape and geometry, right? So, you know, and I have to confess that here, in order to figure out exactly what these events were, we cheated a little bit. We looked in the news to figure out on that time what actually was happening in New York City, right? But this kind of question, when you find interesting features in your data, is something that happens a lot when you're doing data analysis, right? So if we go back to our plot, to the of all taxi trips over 2011 and 2012, I talked about regularity, but you also see some outliers, some things that are out of the norm, right? And one valid question is, you know, are these big drops in the number of taxis in New York, are these a data quality problem? Is it the case that the data was not properly transferred from the taxis to the servers that accumulate the data? Or do these actually correspond to real events that occurred in New York City, right? And having lived through at least two of these events in August and October, I had a hunch of what they might be. So what I looked at was, you know, another data set to try and help explain those events. And because I knew what they were, I looked at wind speed, right? And those days are actually days that correspond to hurricanes, where you have unusually high wind speed. Right? So the intuition here is that, you know, we can actually leverage the very large number of data sets to try and help us explain or understand these kind of events, right? And finding these relationships across data sets not only help us understand events, but also answer important questions that can actually help solve real problems or design policy. For example, one may want to find, you know, what are the relationship between traffic speed and number of accidents, right? Does traffic speed actually cause more increased taxi speed, traffic speed actually increase the number of accidents, or what other factors may actually contribute to the number of accidents, right? Another question that we in New York, you know, face all the time and we are always unhappy about is when it's raining, good luck finding a taxi. So you may want to know, why is it the case that it's hard to find a taxi when it's raining, right? And the hope is that if you find the cause, you may try to find solutions or policies that counter that, right? So really what we'd like to do is to find these, what we call urban data interactions, because by uncovering relationships across disparate data sets, we can better understand the city, how its different components actually work together, right? It's kind of like if you think of a city as a computer program, right? It's like, can we actually reverse engineer the code of that program for which we don't currently have the source code, right? And the other thing that you can do is you can actually discover important attributes that you should take into account when you're actually designing predictive models for some of these questions. All right, so that's you know, nice vision and can have lots of benefits. The question is where to start, right? The data are available, there are lots and lots of data sets, and answers to these problems are likely in the data, right? But there are just too many data sets, and even more attributes in these data sets that you can actually have interactions over, right? So just if you look at the New York City Open Data website, there are over 1,200 data sets and an average of 8 attributes per data set. So it's like a very large number of attributes. And just the weather data has over 200 data sets. So if you have to sift through all these different data sets and all the different attributes, good luck if you have to do that manually. So this is what motivated us to develop what we're calling the data polygamy framework. And the goal here is to allow users to ask relationship queries. Right? So the, you know, given a data set that you're analyzing, you can actually ask, what other data sets are related to my data set D? Right? And the name polygamy doesn't come from the fact that I lived in Utah for 7 years, but because when you look at these data sets, they can be related to zero or more data sets through many different attributes. So these data sets are very polygamous. Right? So what are the challenges to make this work? First and foremost, we need to define what we mean by relationships, right? When and how are two data sets related? And one thing that we realize is that some of these relationships only become visible through atypical behavior, right? So, and I'm going to go into more details shortly about this. Right? And then if you look at conventional techniques that people have used for finding correlation, like Pearson's correlation, mutual information, DTW, they actually take into account entire data sets, and they will miss these relationships that occur through atypical behavior. Right? So if you look at the example that I gave, for most of the time, the taxi data and wind speed have no correlation whatsoever. That correlation only occurs in these, you know, unusual days where you have unusually high wind speed, right? And the other challenge that we have to face is that we have to deal with spatial-temporal data, right? And that makes the problem, you know, more challenging. So additional challenges, as I already said, we have many different data sets and even more attributes. And because relationships can occur between any pair of attributes, we have lots and lots of relationships to analyze, right? These data sets can be large. We have lots of small data sets, but we have data sets like the taxi data, which has, you know, almost a billion records, right? And the other issue is that data sets come at different resolutions. So the taxi data has latitude, longitude, but some other data sets come with, you know, aggregated over neighborhoods, zip codes, census tract, and so on, right? And you end up with a combinatorially large number of potential relationships that you have to evaluate. So if you just consider a single resolution and through the 300 data sets from NYC Open Data, we have almost roughly 2.4 different relationships, right? So really, this is kind of like looking for a meaningful relationship is really like looking for a needle in a haystack. So how did we address these challenges? First, you know, how and when are two data sets related? So we go back to the use of computational topology. Right, so just like in the previous, you know, event detection work, we actually use a topological representation for all our data sets, right? And we define, you know, we say that two data sets are related if their salient features, the salient features in their topological representation, are actually related. Right? So the first step of the framework is we get all data sets and we model them as scalar functions. And we do that for each attribute in the data set. So we model this slightly different than in previous work. Instead of going from a graph to a real value, we go from space and time, a spatial temporal point, into a real value. Right? And here we can use any kind of function that you'd like that captures the kinds of the aspects of the data that you want to analyze. So for example, you can use count. You can look at density or number of unique taxis. And you can also look at attribute values to figure out, you know, attribute variation, like, for example, you know, how the fare varies or how the distance of the trip varies, right? And these functions are actually computed for all possible resolutions for the data, right? So here's an example. On the left, we have you know, a very high resolution grid, whereas on the right, we have we compute the scalar function based on our neighborhood resolution. Right? So once you have this topological representation of the different attributes in your data set, we now try to attempt to find what the salient features are, right? And these salient features are defined by, by their neighborhood, and we have thresholds to select what points are interesting belong to these salient features, right? And in this case, we use the notion of topological persistence, which corresponds to the importance or of the critical points that you find in the function. Right? And again, we use merge trees, which are very efficient to identify these features at all different resolutions. And one big advantage of this method is the fact that it's output sensitive, meaning that the complexity is proportional to the number of events that we find. So it can be done very, very efficiently. Right? And one thing that I forgot to mention, although we use a threshold, this threshold can actually be automatically computed in a data-driven fashion. So, you know, the users need not, you know, manually set this kind of threshold, right? So once you have the salient features, what you do is we have a set of points that are interesting points. And to identify the relationships, essentially we're joining points from different scalar functions. So in this case, as we have an example of a positive relationship where you have a peak in the top function and a peak in the bottom function, right? So these two join right there, and you can also, and this is kind of like corresponds to positive correlation. But you can also have, you know, negative relationships which correspond to inverse correlations where a valley in a function matches a peak in another function, right? So in summary, the relationship between two different scalar functions correspond to the set of points, spatial-temporal points that are features in both functions, right? The join that I just mentioned. So for example, if you have the Hurricane Sandy, there's a negative feature there that connects the wind speed with the number of taxis. Right? And of course, we have lots of different relationships, so we defined a few measures to quantify, you know, both the nature of the relationship as well as the importance or strength of the relationship. Right? The other problem that we have to address is the fact that we have too many relationships, and many of them can be coincidental, like false correlations. And to address this, we actually modified Monte Carlo tests to take space and time into account so that we can actually prune these relationships that are not meaningful. Okay, so we implemented the framework using MapReduce, and one very nice feature of the framework is that the key operations that we need to perform, both feature identification and relationship evaluation, are embarrassingly parallel. So they lend themselves very well to a MapReduce kind of implementation. And we did experiments with two different collections. We got the 300 data sets from NYC Open Data that have spatial-temporal components, as well as some other data sets, very large data sets that we obtained directly from New York City agencies, including 311 data, crime data from NYPD, taxi data, and some others. Right? And we ran our framework over that. I don't have time to go into details on the actual experiments. They're, you know, you can read about them in our paper, but just like to point out that, you know, the approach is really efficient. If you look at, you know, over the 300 data sets, it took using a cluster, small cluster with just 20 nodes, a little bit over 200 minutes to compute all the scalar functions and features for the 300 data sets, and 60 minutes for the smaller collection. Right? The approach scales linearly with the number of nodes. So if you have 100 nodes, it's going to be 5 times faster. So it can really scale to much larger data and much larger number of data sets, right? And we can have a very high query rate. 10^4 relationships can be evaluated per minute in our cluster, right? We also did a number of experiments in terms of trying to assess the correctness. Are we finding really meaningful relationships? As well as robustness by, we actually artificially perturbed some of the data sets to see whether, you know, the technique was robust to find these features and relationships, right? We made the code, and all the experiments in our papers are reproducible. You can get them on GitHub, and you can rerun them and give us feedback. But before I finish, I'd like to give some examples of interesting relationships that we found in the data. So for the question of reducing traffic speed, you know, does it actually lead to a reduction in the number of accidents? And the framework did find that there is a positive relationship between the number of collisions and speed. But it also found another relationship, that there is a positive relationship between the number of fatalities and traffic speed, right? So what is interesting here is that right after Mayor de Blasio took over in New York City, he actually put a new law in effect that reduced the speed limit in New York from 30 miles per hour to 25 miles per hour, right? So actually through the data, we can actually see that this may have been a good decision, and I'm looking forward to having more data for the following years to see whether we can actually see this improvement in the actual data and we can still find these kind of relationships, right? For the second question, in terms of why is it so hard to find a taxi when it's raining, we did find a strong positive relationship between rainfall and the average fare. And this actually supports a long-standing hypothesis that taxi drivers are target earners. And here the rationale is, you know, they set a quota. When it's raining, there is higher demand. They make more money earlier. They go home, and we stand in the rain waiting for a taxi that is never going to come, right? And what was very interesting in this particular example is that in 2014, Farber wrote an article that refuted this hypothesis. Because he did not find a correlation using OLS regression between drivers' earning and rainfall, right? And there are two important problems in his analysis. One is that he did not take into account the amount of rainfall. He considered rainfall as a Boolean. You know, it's either there is rain or there is no rain. And he also considered the entire time period, right? So essentially, you know, periods of sparse rain or very heavy rain were considered the same, right? So this underscores the importance of considering the salient features when you're trying to find explanations or answers to these kinds of questions, right? So I had another example, but I'm going to skip this one. And to conclude, I hope I convinced you that there's a lot of opportunities now for us to analyze the data exhaust from cities so that we can better understand cities and address the pressing problems that we are currently facing, right? And, you know, we see all open data, all cities, Seoul, Rio de Janeiro, New York, everywhere, people are making data available. So data has been already democratized. The biggest limiting factor right now is that people like us with technical background that know about computing, we can analyze this data. But the people that really need to ask and answer these questions, they can't do it. So we really need to democratize not just the data, but the data, whole data analysis process, right? So I told you about some steps we in my group have taken towards democratizing data analysis, how to make it easy for people to interactively explore large volumes of spatial-temporal data, how to automatically detect events so that you can guide users in you know, the exploration to find interesting features, as well as this data polygamy framework that you know, provides a first step towards helping people explain the events that they find in data, right? And I should point out that data polygamy is not just useful for explaining these features, but it can be very, very useful for data discovery, right? Since we are drowning data, many different data sets, it can help guide you to find data sets that may be relevant to answer your questions, as well as give you hints in terms of variables and parameters that you need to consider when you're creating predictive models. I should also point out that when you're trying to solve these kind of problems, and I hope that you saw in the work that I talked about, but in many projects that we carry out in my group, to solve these, you know, real problems, you really need to have interdisciplinary teams, right? So some of the ingredients that you saw in the methods we have developed, we see visualization, visual analytics, we see database techniques for indexing, we see computational topology, right? So it's kind of like you need to mix and match a bunch of these techniques from different areas of computer science to come up with these solutions. And it's also very important if you really want to solve real problems and come up with practical solutions that are adopted, you have to work closely with domain experts. So it's not only interdisciplinary within computer science, but also with other domains. Right? And I think that is a great recipe for success and impact. Right. I should point out that these were just first steps. There are lots of open problems, very interesting computer science problems to be addressed, and some of them we're actually working, like, for example, how to deal with streaming data, how to do very large-scale information integration. Right. And I really believe that computer science is, you know, probably the coolest field in the world right now, right? That we are very well positioned, not only to solve very interesting technical problems, but to actually have substantial impact in society as a whole, right? So let's collaborate and let's develop lots of cool open source tools that help domain experts analyze their data and make big contributions. Thank you so much.